Become our friend on Facebook. Post on our wall your thoughts about our shows and network. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America.
The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit VoiceAmericaVariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit VoiceAmerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Welcome to Waking Up in America with Valerie Kirkgaard. All comments, views, and opinions expressed on this show are solely those of Valerie, her guests, and callers. Now here's your host, Valerie Kirkgaard.
I am here, and you're listening to Waking Up in America. I'm Dr. Valerie Ann Kirkgaard. I'm a firewalker, Olympic torchbearer. Dynamic radio dialogues have been happening over here since 1987. That's when I got bitten by the social concern bug and wanted to start talking about things that people were shoveling under the carpets. And we want to thank our sponsors for this program, Emergency Management Solutions, also known as EMS Global One. Jason Winter Tea, bless that tea. I love the peach tea, honest to gosh, and it tastes incredibly good with on ice, let me tell you. Also, you have theright.com, which is Tad Patterson's work, and he works with secure party creditors, and he gives out all kinds of really good information. And we've got a coughing person in here that needs to actually mute their phone. And we also have coningcompany.com. If you've got sinus problems, you can check a 5,000-year-old tradition, which is ear coning, and you go to Coning Company, CONINGCOMPANY, and read up on it. I think you'll find it quite interesting. Okay? So, C.W. Wright sends his regards. We've got Ken Cousins on here today, along with Peter Brown, whose movie is Confessions of an Eco-Terrorist, bless his heart. And some have referred to him as a pirate. I like that. That was perfect for me. My children have been talking about Pirates Day coming up, Talk Like a Pirate, which is September the 19th. So we've been going around going arg, 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 and all of that good stuff. But you're going to like what Peter's up to. He's up to way more than an arg, and he's been up to it for over 30 years. So I think there'll be an interesting program for you today. If you want to write or ask a question while we're on the air, you can actually send me an email at val@wakingupinamerica.com. Once again, that's Val, V-A-L, at wakingupinamerica.com, and we'll ask your question on the air. Now, Bob Sercosto of the Home Shopping Network says we're doing radio that is changing the world, and we think we are too. And as you share it with your friends, more and more people are coming to our Waking Up in America website, going into the past shows, not the ones that are listed in just the index, but when you click on tune in here, it takes you right over to the radio station, and we've got like 5 years of shows, and you're invited to download them and share them with your friend. If you happen to hear a phone ringing or a dog barking or an angel singing, we call in from our homes and offices all over the United States to cause this program, sometimes even from foreign countries. Now, a lot of you check in here to find out what's happening with the Republic for the United States of America.com is a great place to go and catch up on that information. And we'll have a few little conversations, tidbits that we can share with you today. So I like to start off the program by telling you something that's rotting my socks. And by the way, Ken, there's two things that are rotting my socks this week. One of them is an executive order that says that if you are an illegal alien, but you're enrolled in a college class or you're pregnant, you can become a United States citizen. Have you heard that one?
No, but, you know, it's called incrementalism, one step at a time.
Well, this thing started when people that were illegal aliens could get bank accounts with Bank of America without any Social Security number. And it annoys me that this is how the body count gets built in the United States, because, of course, whether people are aware of it or not, a lot of people in the United States don't realize that they've actually put themselves in a situation as citizens in which they're citizen equals, if you put an equal sign after it, equals slave. So the current government in Washington, D.C., would like more slaves to manage, so, because they can... Pardon?
What they really need is, because, see, the current population, or more accurately to be called the current herd of cattle, have been milked of all the debt and credit that can be milked, and that's why they can't keep expanding and keep their boat afloat. So 10 to 20 million new so-called illegal aliens with Social Security numbers, they can monetize that and expand the monetary base. So that's why they're doing it.
Well, when I was on the Republic call last night listening to the president, one of the things that was being said was that foreign countries are not respecting the United States anymore. Do you know anything about the marking down of our AAA rating? And I thought it was interesting that we actually, under this particular system that is collapsing right now, we actually would have to remain in debt to remain, quote, solvent.
Mm-hmm.
Did you see the tape from Ben Bernanke? It's about a 29-second tape, and he goes, oh, we will never collapse because we can always print money?
Yeah. Well, they call him Helicopter Ben. He's going to throw boodles of money out of his helicopter as he flies over the land.
Now, I've heard that the stock market will be down to like 600 or 700 within a year.
Hmm.
Have you heard that?
Well, yeah, but who knows really where it's going to go.
But what we do know is that the dollar is being revalued.
Yeah, there's no question about that.
Do you have any idea on how soon that is? Like 30 days, 60 days, 90 days? Have you heard anything in the scuttle?
Well, it's a continuum. It's happening all the time. You know, go to your grocery store. Tell me if the grocery store, if the dollar
is
not being
devalued. There's a video being circulated somewhere that actually says, is there a shrinking gun that's been sold to people that are shopping? And if you've noticed all the containers at the markets and everything, they've gotten quite a bit smaller, and 16 ounces have turned into 10 ounces or 12 ounces. And
right.
I know that I like U-Ban can, and it's gone up from, at Vons, I think it's selling for $14.99 a can, something like that.
Mm.
So. Yeah, it's happening in that way, but we're headed for gold-backed money. Anyway, I was at the post office yesterday, and Lon, took one look at my shirt, Ron Haber, and commented on it. I was wearing one that had Lux lighting on it and so on and so forth, and we started talking about it. I was telling him how I like to collect T-shirts, and he says, well, I've got a great T-shirt for you, and we started talking about Peter Brown. Well, that name actually was familiar with me, and then he started talking about, but I couldn't remember where I'd heard it from. And you actually have been watching Whale Wars, right?
Mm-hmm.
You want to comment on that?
Well, Ken said he was watching it. I actually don't watch Whale Wars. This is Peter.
Hey there, Peter.
I kind of lived it on television, you know. I don't have to relive it.
Well, tell us what Whale Wars is. I was actually trying to get one of your viewers to comment on what they had seen, because he did not know you were going to be on today. And when I told him you were going to be on, he goes, really? I watched Whale Wars.
Oh, yeah, there you go. Well, actually, Whale Wars is a television company that came on board a Sea Shepherd campaign. Sea Shepherd has been around for 30 years doing campaigns against illegal fishing and whaling and sealing around the world. And Whale Wars came on because I guess it sounded like good TV for them. And it turned out that they've been there, I think, 4 seasons or 4 years going after the whalers in Antarctica.
So, what kind of successes have they had?
Well, I don't know. I guess Whale Wars considers themselves a success because people watch, but Sea Shepherd has very good success over the years. In Antarctica last year, we thought that the Japanese had totally given up and they went home very early without catching whales, but looks like they're going to come back again this year, so we're going to have to go down again.
Now, I'm looking at your nice little sheet and Roger Ebert and the Chicago Times, and people have said this thing about this film, which is...
It's the story of my 30 years in the environmental movement, kind of behind the scenes, and how we played the media game to actually, you know, found the movement. 30 years ago, no one knew what ecology meant. Today, everybody's trying to be green.
Right. Well, Confessions of an Eco-Terrorist. That's
the title.
What's the most terrorist thing that I don't quite know what to do with that word.
Well, it isn't a word that we call ourselves. We're actually not terrorists at all. We're conservationists, the ultimate conservatives. But other people that don't like you, like enemies everywhere, you know, would give you a label, and terrorism is a label they gave to Sea Shepherd.
Is that because you fight back?
We generally go after illegal operations and under the UN Charter for Nature, which gives non-governmental groups permission to enforce international regulations on the high seas if governments don't do it. So if we were in fact terrorists, I couldn't travel around in my job. Paul Watson couldn't travel around and speak all over the world. So the bottom line is, it's just the title in my film kind of answers who the real terrorists are, I think.
So tell us about your film.
My film is basically my story of how I got involved in the environmental movement 30 years ago. And through my passion and business, I was in the television business, we helped promote two gentlemen, Bob Hunter and Paul Watson, and their ideas to a point that we made it an issue in the world where people think that being green and protecting our oceans is generally a wise thing to do. You know, we always shut down one operation, it pops up somewhere else, because humans are quite greedy, but, you know, at least as far as success goes, we're a huge success because people actually are interested. And that's all you can really do. You have to change consciousness. You can fight small battles and stop this person or that person from killing whales, but, you know, you have to stop the world from wanting to kill whales. And whales to us, I think, to me anyhow, is a symbol of, you know, saving the oceans. And I think it's time we get together and do something about saving the ocean.
Well, those whales that they're killing, they're actually killing them for something fairly small, aren't they, as I recall?
Well, they claim they're killing them for research, but, you know, I'm not a real expert on this. I'm not a scientist. I just play one on TV. But there's no research papers being involved. They take an ear bone, I think, but they sell the meat in Japan. I mean, it's a huge multi-million dollar operation, and they just don't do it to get an ear bone. They do it to try to make a profit, and their profit was selling these whales. And if they don't get the whales to sell, they can't make a profit. And as the Japanese culture and the people age, fewer and fewer people even want to eat whale meat. I mean, it's disgusting from what I understand.
That's really don't know. When I was a little, well, let's say 60 years ago, okay, I don't know if you remember Winnie the Whale with the detachable tail.
I don't remember that story, but
okay. Well, Winnie—they called her Winnie the Whale, and Winnie was actually in the Los Angeles Harbor and lost her tail.
Oh, there you go.
Due to a ship propeller cutting it off, and what happened was they embalmed this whale and they took it around.
Well, you know, it's the same argument about aquariums and stuff. I mean, are they good? Animal rights people think they're bad. I'm more of a conservationist. I think that we have to let people know what's going on out there, and we have to make people aware that these animals and fish and mammals exist, and they're not just for our exploitation. So I'm not big for capturing wild animals, but
well, they weren't captured. This animal had died. this fish had actually died in the harbor. What it did for me at the age of 11. Was it actually, first of all, I didn't know anything that big in the world. I had seen another dead whale on the beach in Carmel, okay, and I was like dumbfounded at the size of this. And I walked around that whale, and then I saw Winnie down on 2nd Street in Santa Monica a few years later. So in the first 11 years of my life, I saw two dead whales, and so it gave me... the whale in Carmel was dying from, even then, from pollution, okay?
Well, yeah, I mean, we all die from pollution. Sooner or later, it's going to affect the whales just like the rest of us.
So seeing that an animal that big, or a mammal, they're mammals, aren't they?
They're mammals.
That a mammal that big could be killed from pollution when I didn't even understand it. Now, as you've gone on these journeys around the world, I read the Los Angeles Times Oceans articles about 5 years ago. Did you see that?
You know, probably I read the Los Angeles Times because I've lived here the last 30 years.
Oh, well, it was huge. It went on for days, okay?
I remember seeing that, yeah.
Yeah, well, one of the things that they were showing in there was an area in the Pacific where the tides all come together and there were mounds and mounds and mounds and mounds of plastic and things like that.
Actually, there are five of them around the world.
There are five of them?
Gyres, yeah. And they're not mounds and mounds anymore. They're actually broken down into what they call nurdles, which are almost very small, small particles. But it's still out there, yes.
Yeah, and then they were also talking about in the barrier reef that divers were diving into the water and being burned by toxic substances. And I was wondering, in your journey to assist the whales, what have you seen in the oceans?
Well, it all boils down to habitat destruction. I mean, you see habitat destruction everywhere you go, especially third world countries where they just dump pollution into the harbors and everywhere. So, I mean, we as humans just have to realize that the planet's only so big and we cannot continue to use our oceans as dumping grounds, and we can continue to take all the fish because they're the people that keep the planet going. They're the organisms that, they keep this planet afloat. They're the crew. And as we as passengers, we humans don't add much to this planet, but we certainly take a good ride. And the crew on this planet, we can't keep killing them off or the boat's going to sink. And we have come to a time that I tell people we're on the Titanic. We either go to the dining room and watch the band play, or we go to the deck and try to save the ship. And I'm more of the going to the deck and trying to save the ship.
So were you a sailor when you were young?
Well, I was growing up on Cape Cod, so we had water all around us. So I've been around the water my whole life.
What did you call those five areas again? You had a name?
Gyres.
How do you spell that?
I think it's G-Y-R-E-S.
And what does that word actually mean?
I think it means like whirlpool type situation.
I was going to say a pile of mess. This is the translation.
Well, it's where all the oceans come together. And years ago on a drift net campaign and with Sea Shepherd, we found all these ghost nets in that area. They'd all collected there.
Now, say what a ghost net is.
A ghost net were, drift nets were anywhere between 40 and 170 miles long. And if they lost them off the ship, they still floated and killed fish and kind of balled up and became
there are nets that are 170 miles long.
Well, they've actually been outlawed now, actually, because of what Sea Shepherd and other groups did back in the early 90s. But yes, they were drift nets, and the longest one they ever found was 175 miles long. We found them over 40 miles long.
How can that even be managed?
Well, they set them out like long strings, and in the morning. And they pick them, they let the fish come up and get caught them in at night, and then they go back around like a big assembly line and pick them up the next day. They can pick them up at like 8 or 10 knots. It was quite an operation. It was really killing the oceans. I mean, it was a major threat.
And what period of time did this cover?
Well, they were ultimately outlawed in 1992.
Okay. And they went from when, approximately when to when?
Well, I think the technology, we first went out after them in 1986 when they first became an issue for us. I mean, as an environmental group, you don't always hear about things. The oceans are a big place. So during the 90s, in the early 90s, they were setting enough drift net, the Japanese and the Taiwanese fleets, to circle the globe two times, two and a half times every single night. So they had.
Get out! That's a heck of a lot of net.
Absolutely, and that's where we as Sea Shepherd started ramming boats because it got people aware of what was going on, and we saw it was a good tactic to make people aware of the issue, so we could talk about it.
Now, is this Paul Watson? Was he the one that started the organization Sea Shepherd?
Paul Watson was a founder of Greenpeace, and in 1979, he left Greenpeace and started the organization Sea Shepherd Conservation Society.
And when did Greenpeace get started?
I was never a member, but Bob Hunter was one of the founding members. I think it started in 76, didn't it, somewhere like that.
Yeah, those were good years.
well, I mean, the people of that age, of my age, you know, had gotten out of the anti-war movement, and we had seen that, giant movements can change perception and change, you know, laws and reality. And I said, we just stopped the war in Vietnam. It was something that hadn't ever been done before. And so, you know, we as individuals moved on to where else could we save?
Well, I went, you went into the ocean, I went to the women's movement. Okay?
Yeah, there you go.
And I was the associate coordinator of Los Angeles Now, and we got women's wages up and quite a few other things.
Oh, God love you. Everybody should have a passion, you know. That's what makes people alive. That's why, you know, people look at my movie and say, gee, most movies are so, you know, dour and sad and dark, and yours is so happy. And I said, well, I had a ball doing it. And the passion just led to more people being passionate, and hopefully in the future more people being passionate, and we'll actually get something done.
Well, Peter, actually there's usually three or four of us on the show, and Ken and I are the ones that are here today. There's a lot of stuff happening in our universe. We're actually all members of something called the Republic of the United States of America. Have you heard of that?
You know, I don't listen to much media, so no, I haven't heard of that.
Okay, well, I'm going to suggest that you hop over and check out republicforTheUnitedStates.org, because what we've actually done is we've actually gone in and re-inhabited the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. And if you notice, those things have been rather severely ignored for the last 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 150 years. You know, it was
the Bill of Rights were revolutionary, and it was a revolution. When governments take over, ultimately they want to put that stuff down. You know, they want to put forward thinkers down. And that's what's happened all over the world. It's good in America we have some kind of partial, you know, freedom of speech, and we can actually, you know, keep the burned fires going, so to speak.
Well, you know, are you aware?
And by the way, I'm here, Val.
Oh, Dr. Rutledge, hi. So
yeah, yeah, I've been on since noon.
We didn't know. We didn't know you were there.
Word in edgeways, huh, Doc?
yeah, that's it.
So, this is Dr. Rutledge, okay, Peter.
Hello.
And
hi.
Dr. Rutledge, he's put together his own documentary, which is $3 Billion and Counting, which is on DDT.
On DDT?
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah, great. You know, it's, you know, that the banning of DDT in America was a big success. Unfortunately, you know, they dumped it everywhere else, but it's always a start. You know, you got to keep going on those things. They never...
What do you think, the DDT is good or bad?
I think DDT ultimately, well, it depends on how you look at it. If you were getting eaten by mosquitoes, maybe it would be good, but I think in general it killed the birds, it killed a lot of things.
See, I'm so glad Dr. Rutledge is here.
And I, from what I know of it, and I'm not, like, that's not my area of expertise, but, you know, it seemed the bird populations came back when it was, and things like that, so that's all I know. I'm not.
So, Dr. Rutledge, would you like to comment?
Yeah, go for it.
Well, I mean, I guess I'm somewhat of an authority on it, just because I've done so darn much research on it, you know, for 5 or 6 years, you know, going back to the 1930s and 40s. And that is what was popularly known, but actually the data shows that bird populations were increasing during the high peak years of DDT use, which was in the 50s and 60s. And most of that data turns out to be flawed, and the true science that shows that DDT is a moderate toxic pesticide, not super toxic, but it's definitely not toxic to humans, animals, or birds in the environment. What it is toxic to is insects. So primarily my documentary was about malaria in the third world, and how them not having access to it is resulting in millions of deaths, you know.
Well, yeah, malaria is a huge... I spent a lot of time in Africa. It's a huge disease. It's all, you always worry about it even being there.
If you don't have to worry about it with DDT, do you?
Well, you know, that's the whole thing. You know, biostitutes, we call them, you know, scientists working for corporations. It's very easy to get scientific information the way you want it to be. So it's always good to have everybody look at the real data, you know. I'm all for that.
Yeah.
Good. I love having the documentarians on here. Maybe you'd like to say something about Rachel Carson, Dr. Rutledge.
Well,
because
she's a biologist.
It's really given a lot of people the misconceptions that they have. And you remember what happened when you said that you ate DDT, and I had a fit and said, you're not talking about that on my show.
Yeah.
If you recall.
Well, yeah, I do. You know, Rachel Carson was a biologist and worked with fisheries and different areas. And then I think it was with the USDA or Agricultural Society at that time in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And she wrote, I think, one or two books before Silent Spring. When she wrote Silent Spring, it was to alert people of overuses of pesticides and things. However, what I found was that most of the data and stuff she could not back up, and more than anything, that her co-author for about 3 months was a fellow by the name of Diamond, and he was the science editor of Newsweek magazine, and he pretty much said he didn't want any part of the book because it was propaganda, you know, causing people to think that their world is becoming poisoned. So I think many people got on the bandwagon with that, and the environmental movement was started at that time. And all the data, they didn't have all the data laid out in front of them, scientifically speaking.
Well, Congress did that big investigation, too. What year was that?
Well, the trial was in 1972 on DDT, and it was 7 months of hearings, 9,000 pages of testimony, and primarily it gave DDT a clean bill of health. Now, what they kept pressing was a precautionary principle, you know, and, you know, there's when you get into proving harm, it's easy to prove harm or not, but it's hard to prove whether something may cause harm.
Well, double-blind studies are difficult in that regard.
What
yeah,
was the name
exactly.
of that guy that actually banned the DDT? I forget his name.
William Ruckelshaus.
So inside, you can see what's, you know, you can see that the people on this program are concerned and talk about stuff, Peter, that a lot of people just don't talk about. Out of all the things that we're mentioning here, and Ken, you know, you want to jump in and ask him a question, just interrupt because
okay.
I'm real jazzed by having this happen here. So talk to us about the things that you see are possible, Peter, or I don't know what fascinated Ken. I don't watch Whale Wars at 2 in the morning, okay? So I don't know what had him do that. Maybe.
Well, I think it's on all the time. You know, it's one of those shows where they, you know, on cable television, they get it once, they run it every forever.
So what made you keep watching that, Ken? What made you keep coming back to Whale Wars? Or, yeah.
Well, it's actually very well produced, and it's exciting. And, of course, it's, you know, it's a reality show, really, in the proper definition of that, and because you're just living it with the crew, and you're living their emotions and the anguish of what they're dealing with, and the passion of what they're doing to protect the whales, and it's a very intense thing. You know, they're out there at the bottom of the planet where it's freezing cold, and they're going through ice floes and ice patches, and it's a hide-and-seek game with the Japanese whaler ships. There's a big factory ship, and then there's the killing ship, or multiple killing ships, and, you know, they have to line up together because if they make a kill, they have to get it to the factory ship. And so it's a very intense game. It's got very real consequences. One of the programs I watched, they had this, real high-tech, sleek boat. I forget what they called it.
Eddie Hill.
It's called what?
Called the Eddie
Hill.
Eddie. He's talking about the one that got hit.
Right, but I mean, how would you describe that kind of ship? It's like a big torpedo on the surface that can just slice through the waves. So it moves very fast, and it just got caught the wrong place, the wrong time. The Japanese ship veered right into it, ran him over, you know, and could have killed the crew. Yeah, it sunk, but the crew fortunately got out, you know, and it's, and then of course the crew planned some revenge. I don't think I saw all of the shows, but, the man who's, some Central European country. Was he Czechoslovakian?
Actually, no, he was New Zealander, actually.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Okay. Anyways, it was his baby. He nursed it to birth and for 5 years and was ready to go, and they rammed it and sunk it, and so he was very pissed, so he wanted to get revenge. So they snuck him onto one of the Japanese ships, and I don't think I saw what happened. Peter could tell us, I'm sure.
Well, you know, I actually was off that year. It's a volunteer job for me. I don't go every single year. I mean, it's
okay.
A TV show, but, you know, I don't do it to be on TV. I kind of do it to save whales, so... I go from time to time, but yeah, the guy got brought back to Japan, and they were tried. It was all a lot of drama. But the bottom line is, they had to go home with fewer whales killed. I mean, that's the way
that's
I look
the
at
game.
It.
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned something about when I was asking you what they wanted from the whales. You mentioned something about ear bones. What did they do with ear bones?
Well, they claim that's their research. It's a research. They if you look at their boats down there, they all have research printed on the side of them in like 12-foot letters in English. To show they're not really killing whales for food, they're killing whales for research. But the only research that they've ever, like, talk about doing is ear bone research, which is a tiny little bone in the ear of a whale.
Right. That's why I didn't...
Well, why not? I mean, they got to pick something.
Yeah, it's just ridiculous. And,
it's ridiculous. It's for whatever reason, they are killing those whales to sell, hoping to sell them. And, you know, the whole farce about research and everything is just really a farce. They haven't printed any, you know, real serious research material on it. And, you know, you don't really have to kill whales to find out why whales are dying.
Yeah, they're dying because humans are
killing them. Yeah.
So as you've been cruising on the oceans...
Pardon me?
As you've been cruising over the oceans for the last 30-plus years, what changes have you been noticing and what things do you think have been accomplished, if any?
Well, the changes you notice is there's a lot less wildlife in most areas, in general areas, not all areas. Some areas are coming back. If we allow them to come back, they generally come back pretty well. The fish around Los Angeles here and the Catalina Island and those areas have come back quite well. So, and the successes, you know, you have successes. You shut down illegal operations. But it doesn't help unless you can change opinion. I look at what we do and Sea Shepherd does as like a holding action until the public and humans realize that we have to live on a sustainable planet with a sustainable culture and a sustainable population. Otherwise, you know, there's not going to be anything for us to eat, ultimately.
Now, at your website, what is it, Confessions Film?
The website is, confessionsfilm.com.
Right, I went and I watched the... I watched the trailer, and there was, who was ramming whom?
Well, and it's happened both ways. It's part of the game, you know. The rammings are quite dramatic, especially for people who don't normally see them. And, you know, they get public awareness. It's how we, if there are 1,800 DriftNet ships, it doesn't do you a whole heck of a lot of good to ram one or two of them. It does do you a whole heck of a lot of good if those pictures make it onto the nightly news around the world and 100 million people see it and say, wow, nets that circle the globe twice every night, we have to do something about it.
Yeah,
well, then you're successful, and we have been successful over the years.
Yeah, that's totally shocking. You know, what I wanted to do is I want Ken Cousins is actually Chief Justice of the California Republic Supreme Court. And
do I need a lawyer?
No,
you got one.
Not.
Actually, I think he'd be on your side, wouldn't you, Ken?
well, no.
He's not breaking.
We We follow the Shakespearean motto, which is the first thing we have to do is get rid of all the lawyers. So, no, it's, well, value.
Well, I don't, just so you know, I don't do anything. I can't stand up in court and say, right to everyone, I did this.
Right.
Well,
exactly,
actually... He's actually enforcing international law, right, Ken?
There you go.
Well, yeah, and, you know, I think you're leading to, I'll give Peter a brief synopsis. What Val was referring to in very short terms is we started this country as a republic made up of sovereign nations. Each state is a sovereign republic, and the union was created to interface amongst nations in the international law of nations. The people, meaning at that time the free white landed males, were actually sovereigns, equal to a king or queen as a monarch. Long story made short, by the time of the Civil War, post-Civil War, things were turned upside down and inside out so that the federal government became a corporation and incorporatized everything. And that corporation went bankrupt in 1933. And ever since then, the whole monetary system has been structured as an indenturing of the people and all the assets in the country as monetized, collateralized surety against a perpetually expanded, never payable debt, which equals debt enslavement and economic, basically economic enslavement. That is truly, actually, once you really understand it, the root of all the problems on this planet, because all the laws or so-called laws, corporate rules, statutes that have been created in the last 100 years are designed to be for the benefit of corporations to maximize profit. The same model exists in Japan. That's why the Japanese whalers do and how they do what they do. The courts are commercial enterprises to maintain corporate business models and benefits, and et cetera, et cetera. So the Republic never went away. It was just uninhabited. And we properly and lawfully re-inhabited it, and now we hold the law. We have a superior jurisdiction in law, and this is actually recognized worldwide, although the corporation called the United States Inc. in Washington doesn't like us, doesn't want to see us emerge, because if we do, then the people take back control of their land, their law, their money, and all the rest of it. But the thing is, once we do achieve that, the kind of strength and support that it would offer endeavors such as what you're doing, what Paul's doing, and so forth, to get a true balance of, balancing economics with sustainability, all that kind of stuff. You know, I'm very familiar with the environmental movement. I went to college in Northern California in the early 70s when we were trying to save the redwoods, and I was very involved with that. And, so I was immersed in that community, and it's near and dear to my heart. And, you know, I came out of the same environment that you did, the anti-war, then into the environment, and then social awareness. And it led me into the realms of law, history, and money. And I've studied history very extensively, and, of course, we don't have time here, but we could boil it down to understanding law, history, and money is truly the root of this, you know, self-genocide, self-destruction that you're fighting against. And I agree, it's all about raising awareness and consciousness, and that's what we're doing in the Republic.
Yeah, well, good. More power to you. You know, I always say that when we're over, we send our troops somewhere to fight for democracy, that, gee, that'd be funny, we don't have it here in America. We're a republic.
Well, actually, yeah, why don't you really tell them the difference between why don't you tell them what democracy really is, kid?
Well, here's a very simple formula. The difference between democracy and a republic is this. In a democracy, there you have three wolves and a sheep. In a democracy, majority rules, they vote what's for dinner. In a republic, the three wolves have to protect the rights and the integrity of the sheep. So in the democracy, the majority rules and, you know, votes to eat the sheep and controls everything. You know, democracy is very illusory. It's not what it's meant. It's not what it's purported to be. It's a mechanism to promote and sustain corporatism. And if you look at history of the last 100 years, corporatism is defined as the quintessential expression of fascism. That's what Mussolini said. And so we have corporate fascism in this country, and it's endemic in the court system, in the monetary system, and, it's life negating. It supports the destruction of life, and that's what we're, you know, your team and our team, we're fighting the same battle, which is to reassert the integrity and the sanctity of life so that, you know, we can sustain a good future for all living beings.
Absolutely.
And there you go. And also, we just wanted to give people places that you can go to listen to different calls for what's happening. We have constitutional studies where people actually listen and learn about the Constitution, and that's Sundays at 6 Pacific Standard Time at 424-203-8000. And the code for that call is 819 424 pound. Once again, 424-203-8000, code 819054 pound. And that particular combination also works for the Wednesday call, which is at 6 p.m. And can you ask questions on that now, Ken? I can't remember.
Not on the Wednesday, but I think the Thursday show call maybe.
See, we're used to doing shows. The Republic Roundtable is very interesting.
Yeah.
You hear governors from different, all of the republics, all of the states are republics, and they all have, we all have governors from all of those states. It's really cool.
Yeah, and they're all coming back now.
Yep. I'm in the House of Representatives. Another person that's on this show quite regularly is a senator. Our vice president of the Republic, he was not able to be with us today. And another gentleman that's with the Republic, Kelby Smith, he's actually vacationing with his family. And these are just, you know, Peter, how good it is when you get around great human beings. These are great human beings, and you get turned on because you see possibility, things that can be done. On Sunday, we have our Republic Roundtable. On Thursday, we have the Republic Roundtable, which are updates, education, and that's the one that has the question and answers that Ken was referring to, and that's 6 to 7:30, and that telephone number for tomorrow night is 712-432-0075. Once again, 712-432-0075, code number 851-350-POUND, 851-350-POUND. So, and visit our website at republicfortheunitedstates.org. And it just so happens that we have the Secretary of Health and Welfare here. So, would you like to comment on what you're up to this week, Dr. Rutledge?
Well, hang on. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. I've been working on, from the documentary standpoint, the song that we, you know, originally composed and scored for it, that's at the end title credits, I was trying to get a piece of it this morning so everyone could listen to it, but I just was not able to get that back from the masters. They're mastering it now, and the reason is that it will be performed on Good Morning America this Saturday.
Oh, cool.
Great.
And so everyone can tune in and see that. She will perform it with the Harlem Gospel Choir singing background harmonies. So, and it will be available up on iTunes, I believe, either Friday or Saturday around the time of that performance on Good Morning America, so people can get the song and hear it. And I tell you, what's so special about it is the name of it is Rise, and it was for the documentary. However, when you really listen to the lyrics, it is really, really timely of what is going on in the world right now. People are starting to awaken in governments all over the world, and rising up, rising out of the dark and into the light. That is happening right now. So this song will be very universal and very, very timely for what's happening right now within the republics, within the United States, within Europe, all over the world, because it's time for people to rise up, recognize the power that they have within, and be it. And so I've been working on that, and the rest is all the same kind of stuff, you know, just patience and nutrition and powders and mixes and all kinds of things.
We have a little chemist here, Peter. He's quite a talent, I'll tell you, and he's a great human being. I think it's very interesting. Did you and Debbie write that music, or who wrote the music?
We did. She wrote the music, and I co-wrote the lyrics.
So, see, we have a song. Maybe you can hum a few bars, and Peter will have you write a song for him.
I'll listen to it on Good Morning America.
Peter, what do you like best about your movie?
I like best the fact that people actually come out of it with a renewed sense of passion and excitement that maybe they can do something after all the dark days that they've heard about.
So what is the something that they walk away from the film knowing that they might be able to do? What, how does the film put them into action?
I think it gives them the opportunity to do whatever their passion is. The film is about my passion, and it showed how I did it, and I kept the same life, and I, you know, I had two kids, a house in the suburbs, a job, and that if I can do it, and I'm no special individual, that they can do it too, and I think it gives everyone a chance to say, hey, you know, it doesn't look so bad. Maybe I could spend 2 weeks doing that, or maybe I could spend 3 weeks doing that. And I think that's, if they can leave the cinema with the idea, just like Rise, to rise up and be heard, to do something they believe in, they will find that other people believe in it too, and that's how movements begin. So, you know, I just, all we need to do is reach a few people, and they can reach a few people, and they can reach a few people, and sooner or later, we got them all.
Now, Confessions of an Eco-Terrorist, as you said, I believe you said it was opening in Germany in October, was that?
It's opening in Germany and Australia in October and around Europe, and like I said, we don't have a U.S. distributor at the moment. We're talking to people, but it hasn't just made it here yet.
So very good. Now, what are your expectations for this, or... I heard that.
What are my expectations? Well, I'd like everyone to go see it. I think it's, you know, it has something to say. It's something I've been, you know, preaching for a long time, that you don't have to be Paul Watson. You don't have to be Bob Hunter. You don't have to be anybody special. You just have to be interested. And if you are interested and you find that you can do something small, sooner or later you're doing something a little bigger and a little bigger, and then all of a sudden, you know, you think you can save the world, just like we did back in the 70s.
Well, it came out kind of funny when I actually asked you what you thought you could do with this. What I was actually, I was thinking in terms of both you and Dr. Rutledge, because I don't know how really good films, and it sounds like yours is one of the good ones, and Dr. Rutledge's, which I saw, gosh, what was it, probably we saw it 6 months ago, Rutledge. How do you get bigger markets for them, or are there distributors for them, or how do we contact them? Maybe there's somebody listening right now that could actually help with a distributor for both of these films, actually. Do you have a distributor, Dr. Rutledge?
I don't.
So
no.
One of the, yeah, these films...
You do is you build a buzz. You build, you know, with the Internet these days, you have people see it. You get on programs like this. I hadn't heard about Dr. Rutledge's film, but now I'm interested in it. And, you know, people get interested. They start looking on the Internet where they can find it. People find out that there are 1,000 people looking or 2,000 people looking. And I hate to say it, but it's basically all economics. You know, no one's going to distribute it if they don't think they can get, you know, tushes in the seats. And so that's, you know, it's a gamble on their part. They have to put in a lot of money to advertise it and distribute it. So you hope in this day and age through the Internet that people find out about it and they start asking and they want to see it. And then somebody will gamble and take a shot.
So what does it cost to the both of you guys, because I've got two experts here now on this, what does it cost to distribute a film in the United States in case there's listeners that have some money that they don't know what to do with?
Way more than you would think.
$2-3 million?
Well, I don't know. That's when I was in Cannes sitting down at a cocktail bar, actually, and I was talking to one of the producers of The Cove, you know, the movie The Cove.
Yeah, I did. I was horrified. I didn't see the whole movie. I saw the trailers, and I got sick.
Yeah, that was one of the problems, I think, why a lot of people didn't see it. But that's nonetheless, I actually know about Taji, and I got arrested over there years ago in 82.
What did you get arrested for?
Saving dolphins.
What'd they do with you?
Well, they kicked me out of the country never to return, although... We'll see.
Did they? You got arrested in Japan. I thought maybe they caned you or something.
Oh no, they got arrested in Japan. I got thrown out of Japan.
Well, you got thrown out. You were the lucky one, huh?
Well, yeah. I mean, they had little. You know, you got to have done something to get in jail. If you've just done something moral, it's tough for them to keep you, even in Japan. But so in that regard, you know. But yeah, people have to want to see it. And this day, you got on-demand video. There are a lot of ways to get films out, and I think. There's a lot of groups that play them now in videos, and so you can get the word. If you're making a film to get the word out, I think it can be possible.
Yeah, there's actually a guy in Malibu whose name I can't remember at the moment, but what I will do is I will check, because I know that he would actually, he used to be on Dallas. I can't think of it. I almost had his name, and he shows films and things of this nature at his amazing home in Malibu, and he's quite the talented human being. So I will check with him, because I want Dr. Rutledge. Do you remember I told you his name at one time? The guy
in
Malibu.
Yes, I did remember that. Uh-huh.
Do you recall his name?
I don't.
Yeah, this man makes opportunities for films just like this to be seen, and he's very well connected in Hollywood, so some very interesting people come. So once again, I'm going to ask you to take a guess on what it would cost. There are people in the listening audience that have money, okay? And if they like what you've been saying, they may be able to do something for you. So that's why I'm asking for ball, and that's for both of you. That's why I'm asking for ballparks or estimates from either one of you on what you think it would take to have your films distributed in America the way you want them distributed.
Well, the idea is to find a distributor. It costs money to find a distributor. You play in film festivals. You go around. You do this. I don't know how much. It's not really my area of expertise. I make films. I don't normally distribute them. I normally do TV, so. Because, I have to get paid for my hobby, which is the environmental movement.
So
I don't make environmental films, which everyone says don't make any money. So this is my first. But I am finding that I'm spending more time promoting it and marketing the film than I actually spent making it. And so if you're looking at a dollar day, I think, if you want to promote a film and really have a lot of people see it, you either have to get very lucky, like Blair Witch Project did years ago, or you have to be persistent, and you get champions and you build an audience as you go.
So, Dr. Rutledge, if you had $1 million, for instance, would that be sufficient to get your film into distribution?
Well, of course. I mean, that would.
I don't know.
If he had $1 million, he could distribute it himself. You could buy your own advertising and buy your own theaters. But yeah, that's a lot of money. But look at what you're going up against. You're going up against all the movies that they advertise all over TV. So you are after basically the same audience. So you just have to do it. I don't know. I'm learning as we go. But I think he has a good film, and it sounds interesting to me. I want to take a look at it. Some music is going on Good Morning America. That's a good start.
That will be some nice publicity.
I think so. Are you or Debbie going to be on with the music?
Well, she's performing it. Good Morning
She's
America.
Performing it. Okay, that's very cool. How did you arrange that? Just your good looks, right?
It's part of her tour.
It's really nice to have friends in the right places, isn't it, Dr. Rutledge?
Well, good luck, if people will see it, it'll get out there.
Well, what is your... We've got a couple minutes left in the show. Can Dr. Rutledge, Peter Brown, closing comments, a sentence or two?
Well, my closing statement would be that soon enough we are going to have financial resources, and I think the most logical thing is people such as Peter and Dr. Rutledge and others who have made similar documentaries and films, others who plan to make such, come together in a cooperative kind of association and create our own media alliance distribution group so that create an economy of scale, because one producer, one film, it's hard to come out of pocket for all the pieces. But if you have 100 films and it's cooperatively structured so that the economy of scale can act like a big distributor but not have all the impairments of all the bullshit of, oh, am I supposed to say that?
I don't know. We can't play it on regular radio. They'll be bleeped.
All the doo-doo of greed and corporatism. But a cooperative system, that slipped. Anyways, a cooperative system to self-distribute. And that way, the labor, the cost, et cetera, is reduced per participant. But the collective becomes very strong. So I think it's an idea that the time has come, and maybe we should come together with Peter and Rutledge and ourselves and start forming that and move forward and do that.
I totally agree with you, and that was kind of what I was I was trying to have come up without actually formally saying it.
Okay, well, I said it. I said.
I know you said it, and I count on you to say those things, okay?
All right.
So what he's talking about is the fact that there are a number of people that are going to have their wealth shifted rather dramatically fairly soon. I don't know the date on it or something, but it's quite soon. So, and for myself, certainly, those I know of people that are up to this particular endeavor, we want to make sure that humanitarian needs are taken care of. So I would like to just, for instance, a long time ago, I interviewed, I can't remember his name, but it was Deepak Chopra's son, and he was on, there's a channel station that's actually in all the schools, Channel 1.
Yeah, Channel 1 used to be the one that was in the school.
Yeah, and Deepak Chopra's son was a big hit on those channels. And I'm thinking in terms of an educational channel or something of that nature. For instance, in Los Angeles, we've lost our PBS, or not our PBS, but our cable stations. The money that was allotted for them, which is simply taken and put to other projects. It was just kind of rather amazing to watch that happen. So what I'm thinking of in terms of is having an educational channel back that perhaps that may be a way for us to put things into distribution as well, like DirecTV, for instance, is producing its own movies just for the DirecTV channel. So we can take a look at something like that, and I believe, honestly, Peter, that we'll have the funding, and I just really want to thank you for being here with us today. It's like I'm really appreciating the long-term commitment that you've demonstrated.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
And yeah. what do you see as the next step that people need to be taking right now?
I tend to be an operations type person. I'm one step at a time. I think we all have to just continue to keep moving forward and bringing the mass with us. You know, I'm not the glory player. Paul Watson is more. He'll take some big steps. I'll help him if I can. But, you know, I think everybody just has to continue to keep taking steps. I mean, it's easy to get discouraged. It's easy to get down. It's easy to get dark. But I think that the few victories you have, the few times you see your passion actually get something back, is well worth the effort you put into it, and you'll see that the more you do, the more you'll want to do.
Thank you very much. So that's the word from Peter Brown. Visit his website, Confessions. Is it Confessions?
Confessions with an S. Confessions with an S, film.com.
There you go. And also, while you're at it, hop over to 3 Billion and Counting and get those rude facts put there. And between the two of them, we'll have further conversations. And what I want you to know is that Waking Up in America and our Waking Up in America friends, we're here to make things happen. This program has been brought to you by Kirkgaard Media, our radio partners, ConingCompany.com, Dr. James Murphy in Memoriam, DrValerie.com, and Doctor is all spelled out. And we thank our producers, C.W. Wright of Emergency Management Solution, Jason Winter T., Tad Patterson, El Pinto, gosh, get your El Pinto salsa at Rouse. We thank you for that. And to Ron Hayes, our research assistant, and also to our team at Voice America, Brad Comer, thank you for today. And the music that you're hearing in the background was Bent Miguel's Almost Ordinary People that he wrote back in the 80s for this show. So we've been on a long time. Next week, invite a friend to listen. Write us at val@wakingupinamerica.com. And remember, Citius Altius Fortius, the Torchbearer's Creed, swifter, higher, stronger. Until next week, thanks for listening, and next week, bring a friend.
Your sister or your brother.
Thank you for joining us today for Waking Up in America with Valerie Kirkgaard. Waking Up in America can be heard live every Wednesday, 12 p.m. Pacific Time on VoiceAmerica.com, and Valerie welcomes all emails at HeavenIncorporated.com.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program, brought to you on the Voice America Variety.